So perhaps the emergence of this narrative and its quick conversion into a bandwagon.
It's simply not true that facts are or can be separated from values.
Hello and welcome to Between the Bubbles, your place for independent and critical takes on topics at the nexus of science, society, politics, and economics. I'm your host, Ninad Bondre. Thanks for joining me. My guest today is Professor Katrine Brown. She's currently Research Coordinator at the Research Center for Interdisciplinary Risk and Innovation Studies at the University of Stuttgart. She's a political scientist by background, and she focuses on the politics of science, technology, and critical biopolitical studies. She's also the forum editor for the journal Critical Policy Studies. I was alerted to her work by a colleague with whom I had been discussing the notion of post-truth some years ago, and I had expressed my misgivings about this narrative. And a few days later, she sent me a set of articles from the journal Critical Policy Studies, of which two were by Katrine and one she co-authored with a colleague of hers. And when I read those articles, I said to myself, finally, this is the sort of criticism I've been waiting for a long time now. And so when I wrote my article on post-truth a couple of years ago, I referred to Katrine's work prominently, in addition to some other critical work that I sort of synthesized in that article. And when I decided to launch a podcast and do a first season, if you will, on post-truth, I thought Katrine would be a great person to have as a guest, in addition to a few more whom I referred to in that article. So thank you again, Katrine, for joining me.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm so glad that the piece could help to inspire some thoughts.
So I can just start by asking you, or just following the same strand, because I brought up the journal Critical Policy Studies and your articles there. I can just begin by asking you about an editorial you wrote there in early 2018. And you mentioned there that it wasn't news to your community that policymaking, or indeed public opinion, may be shaped by emotions and beliefs as much as, if not more than, objective facts. And that's sort of how Oxford Dictionary defines post-truth. So perhaps the emergence of this narrative and its quick conversion into a bandwagon must have baffled you, as it did me. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what your initial thoughts were when this notion burst onto the scene in 2016, following Brexit and the election of Donald Trump.
Yes, of course. So, I mean, the critical policy studies community that has been around, or has formed in the 90s, late 1990s, and then founded the journal and conferences and so on. And it's a very vibrant community of people who thought it necessary to integrate more interpretive approaches and critical approaches, in the sense that looking for relations of power and power asymmetries and inequality in policy making, and how that plays out. Yeah, so mm-hmm. these two aspects. And the founding assumptions was that this dichotomy of facts and values, you know, which characterizes positivist and empiricist policy sciences for a long time, that this doesn't hold, you know. It's simply not true that facts are or can be separated from values, since everything we think and do is mediated through our perceptions of the world, through language, through meaning making, and also by norms and values. And there's no point in denying that, like the empiricist policy studies do. But the important thing is to reflect upon it and to be critical also of oneself, you know, and one's own work, and ask yourself the question, what are my values that inform what I'm doing, and how do I come to look at this problem and not another one, and why is this a problem and for whom? And so we just were questioning this dichotomy very strongly, and all of a sudden it came back through this anti-Trump movement. And I really thought that there was a backlash. I mean, I was also, like everyone, I think I knew, was of course shocked in a sense by, you know, by this speech of alternative facts, and how can someone just stand there and say, well, we just refer to alternative facts, and it's just a simple matter of choosing. And if we say so, then it is facts, right? So I was shocked by that. But I was also quite, what really baffled me was, for instance, these marches for science, for instance. With their slogan, fight for the science and unite behind the science. So dividing up, you know, the world, the population, in who is for and who is against science.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, that really baffled me. I didn't quite understand what was going on.
No, it was the same for me, actually. I attended one of the marches here in Stockholm, more like an anthropologist almost, because I was really curious to see what was going on. And to me, it seemed a lot like what is sometimes called virtue signaling. So people were sort of wanting to have this community spirit, and they wanted to make sure their peers saw them as being on the right side in some ways.
Yeah, but it's really interesting, because there has been a long tradition of, you know, even these concerned scientists, and that tradition of self-criticism within science as well, you know, and asking, well, is it responsible what we are doing, and do not simply claim authority, epistemic authority, just because they are scientists. And I think that was what was happening there. And I thought that is a bit naive, to say the least.
Yeah, I would agree with it. I actually wrote an article also on this, inspired by this movement, that had more to do with nationalism, because it was a little funny that this movement was, on the one hand, talking about science being universal and facts being, you know, irrespective of anything else. But at the same time, at least in America, there was this parallel discourse of nationalism. So science, you know, American competitiveness, and using science to sort of hold on to that. And Trump essentially is, you know, threatening that number one position that American science could have. So there is a few different things about this. Perhaps there's some work to be done, like in hindsight, on this March for Science movement. Yeah, so for me personally, I was, and I've written in the article also, and in my first episode of the podcast, I have mentioned that I was myself quite confused, because initially, as soon as this notion burst onto the scene, I thought there would be a lot of criticism coming around from academia, at least. And I'm not a practicing academic myself anymore, so I can't claim to follow all communities. But I do read widely, and it seemed to me that there was a lot of silence in terms of any kind of critical take on this. So that's also why I was really pleased to see your pieces there, and also Frank Fisher, whom you referred to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And your piece, again, you know, in 2019, in the same journal, also caught my eye for many reasons, really, because I in some ways I could really just read it out here, because I think it would really be of benefit to the listeners. But you pointed out that post-truth is sort of like an ordering device, and it helps make sense of a complicated world. Maybe you could expand a little bit on this take.
Well, ordering devices, that would be another key topic or instrument of critical policy studies. We all use ordering devices to make sense of the world, to interpret the world all the time. And policymakers do that too, and scientists do it too.
Right.
And there's no way around that, as I said. And that's actually not a bad thing at all. The point is rather to account for which devices you use and why and how, and think about it, and if necessary, reframe your ways of ordering the world. And this is what I was missing in this post-truth discourse. I thought it was quite, what's the word in English, self-complacent, is that the word? Self-righteous.
Self-righteous.
Yeah, so there was very little questioning and reflection on why and how. And well, ordering devices, in this sense, I spoke of a post-truth frame, of a way of framing the situation we're in, the constellation. It divides between before and after, in former times there was truth and now there's post-truth.
Yes.
And
yes.
Something has gotten lost, and there are the truthers and the post-truthers.
Exactly.
And science and the
deniers.
Exactly. And so there's this one reference side, and the others are not even different, but just a lack of, they show
exactly.
A lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding, a lack of reason, and a lack of responsible behavior and democracy and many other things, and actually of morality. The others are always deficient compared to us. Yeah, so that's a very, all dichotomies are problematic as such, I would actually argue. And they because they have this inbuilt hierarchy, there's this one reference and those who are deviant from it, who just don't make it and don't meet the standard. Yeah, and it's simplifying, of course. And in this case, it has been a simplifying response to an already very simplifying other ordering device.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned this deviation, or the deviant, so deniers, and it would perhaps make some sense if these were a small minority of people.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think of even in this U.S. election that happened a couple of years ago, Trump still got something like 70 million votes in that election. So I just find it difficult to understand how one could disagree vehemently, and one could find problems with that sector. But I always found it difficult to understand how we can discount that large, and it's quite a diverse section of the population too, if one really gets into it. But even then, I still seen editorials in the New York Times and op-eds just last month where they sort of portray the Republican Party in toto as a problem to American democracy. And then one wonders, besides the Civil War or something like that, what democratic options are left to engage with your fellow country people. That's a little bit besides the point, but it does, this post-truth framing does raise many allied sort of questions.
Yeah, and it spares you or us, the liberals, reasonable people, it spares us a lot of questions and a lot of digging deeper. There's a quite interesting, I think, a good analysis by Nancy Fraser on that constellation, so I like that a lot too. And she says, there has been a new alliance around since about the 90s, and Bill Clinton did a lot to promote that. She calls progressive neoliberalism, where some parts or strands of feminist and anti-racist and LGBT and so on, criticism of these anti-discriminationist movements, joined or were joined or fused with the forces of financialization and of cognitive capitalism, people working in the cognitive industries,
right,
in the banks, and so who consider themselves to be, liberal and rational and non-racist and all of that, which is fine, on the one hand. But if this is the dominant and the only critical oppositional force in society, then there is a lack of social critique. So the topic of redistribution and social justice has gone lost on the way, and there are no strong political forces left making that strong. And then she says a big part of the population of the electorate, they refuted this constellation in toto, not only the neoliberalist, but also the progressivist aspects about it. Yeah, and a similar thing could have happened, but I think it's really important to study that empirically. Could have happened in France, for instance, now that Marine Le Pen is in the runoff elections. They are voicing social criticism. Maybe not appropriately in our view, but they do. And disassociated from anti-racism and from that type of critique completely.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. I mean, I'm not sure I have read that one from Nancy Fraser, but I certainly agree with how you put it now. And I think the book that I have referred to also, and you also used it in one of your book chapters from Johan Farkas and Yannick Xu on Post-Truth. I think they also go quite a lot into how these aspects of neoliberalism or capitalism have really escaped any kind of, you know, the explanations have really completely missed those or left those aside. And also another colleague, Catherine Happer, who's a sociologist at Glasgow, she's also talked about it from the perspective of media and the public trust in media. So I think that was a great point there. In that same piece also, you mentioned, just to follow up on the points we were already discussing, that how we who have been academics or intellectuals and who would self-identify as the enlightened, when we use this post-truth frame, we find ourselves placed on the side of the good, and then we are exempt from reflecting on our potential biases or blind spots. And I think that's a really incisive critique. And I keep going back to it again and again as various contemporary issues come up. One example I at least thought of was this pathologizing of an other is evident in the discussion about the unvaccinated during the COVID-19 pandemic. And I've read quite a bit which shows, even here in Sweden and the United States, where this group of people who refuse to vaccinate themselves do it for a host of different motivations, only few of which I would say are irrational, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But many others have to do with other social or cultural economic compulsions. But they are still lumped together as this irrational unvaccinated. And it's been quite difficult to bring that critique from the margins to the mainstream. And I feel like there might be a little bit of a danger of liberals continuing to take this position, because again, it cuts off any possibility of politics in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, it's really a mixed bag, for one thing. So that's very important to see and to address this diversity and not to lump it all together, as you said.
Yeah, but I do find this, it's also, if you look at climate skepticism, and I was sort of got into that a decade or so ago when I began working more closely with climate scientists. And then I also wrote a little bit about that. And there too, my problem was with this lumping of people into sort of irrational others or people who were then to be cured by information.
That's it.
That's
the idea. Yeah, we just have to tell them.
Yeah, I mean, what surprises me is that this knowledge or this understanding of how people function and you know, the role of information in that has been around for a while now. And I've read a lot of the work of a Yale University psychologist and law professor called Dan Kahan. And he's done many of these. He's essentially an empirical person. So he's done a lot of experiments to understand how people process information and what are the cultural filters and so on. And he's been writing about that for ages. And I remember reading a blog post of his where he expressed frustration that, you know, it's we've shown graphs, we've shown data, we've shown everything. It's very apparent and evident what the limits of information are and what the drivers of behavior are. But nevertheless, media, communicators, other academics continue to hold on to this belief in information or knowledge as the cure. And I'm wondering whether it's just naivety or is it some political purpose or self-interest is served by clinging on to this?
Yeah, maybe it's both. I mean, on the part of the academics, it's of course nice to think of yourself that, yeah, you do have the means to solve the problem and to tell people, and that's so you're by definition on the right side. But on the part of politics and those who have to take a decision, collectively binding decisions, I think it's rather a mechanism to avoid to address power relations and to do something about that, to take decisions which might intervene into existing vested interests and actually in power. And politicians, to my impression, increasingly shy away from that.
One other point that you made, and which I've also agreed with, is that some of this post-truth narrative or discourse, this mainstream narrative, could be, you know, more specific to the American context rather than being universal. And I've mentioned in my article too that it's somehow, at least in Europe, seems to be very easy for people to look at something American and treat it as universal. Could you maybe say a bit about that?
Yeah, I think there are some aspects of this post-truth frame seem to me very typically American. Mm. Others are maybe more general, yeah. But what's not so much the case in Europe, I would say, as far as I can tell, is there is not that much anti-science attitude, not even in politics in any way. There's still this very strong discourse of modernizing. We have to modernize, and for instance, that means right now we have to digitalize. You know, all sectors of the economy and sectors of life, and to do so, we do need science and we do need technology, and it's great to have that, and we have to promote it. And there is not this anti-science resentment, I would say, not really. And also there is more belief. Not everywhere, but more belief in the media. There are still some quality media in most European countries, and although some TV broadcasting stations are trusted in and maybe also more trustworthy because they are not all owned by Rupert Murdoch or anybody else. Mm. And there is some diversity, so that would be a difference, I think. And so far here, we do not have that strong alliance between, for instance, climate change denial and the working class. But I'm not sure about that, the former working class. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, some of this is to just be studied, I think, also empirically. Mm-hmm. But that's also been my problem with the post-truth story from the beginning, is that instead of treating it like something to examine and to dig deeper into, it was sort of assumed and then people were rationalizing post-facto almost. So we have post-truth now and then let's see how it originated, rather than saying, oh, here's something that's come up and what is this, like, as you did in your couple of articles there in Critical Policy Studies.
Mm. Yeah, well, I did not do really empirical studies. So
no.
I just asked some questions, but we still need the studies to be done, in many fields, absolutely.
But I also have found it confusing, like, I agree with you that the situation regarding trust in science or scientists is different in Europe than in the US, and I've lived in the US many years myself. Mm-hmm. But I also feel that if you look at the surveys that, for example, Pew Research Center does or others do here in Sweden, there's something called Vetenskap and Allmänhet. And these surveys almost invariably show huge public trust in scientists and doctors. And it's 80-90% trust levels. And I've seen surveys from the UK, elsewhere, where this feature is always there. And despite that, people were still marching for science. And the way they were framing it was, a crisis of science. Yeah. And it just, it doesn't seem to be empirically borne out.
Yeah, well, if you were a bit harsh, you could say that people like to see or construct themselves as the victims, you know, and that's not always a good idea. And because you're a scientist, see yourself as a victim to an anti-science constellation, I think that's overrated. That's not quite appropriate. Not everywhere, at least not in Europe, I would say.
And I also think scientists in general, again, this is maybe a gross generalization, but are among the more privileged actors in society. And so it was even more jarring to see them. And I'm sure some were, and some climate scientists definitely have been targeted by the oil industry and so on. But in general, still enjoy more prestige than many other communities. So that also was a little bit difficult to digest for me.
Well, there has, of course, been in Germany too and many other countries a neoliberalization of the universities, of the academic sector, you know, like abolishing the tenure track positions and just having people on very short-term contracts. But that was not due to an anti-science attitude. Right. On the contrary, in a sense, you know, that was done on the assumption or on the ideology, if you want, that we need more competition and the younger ones are more interested, you know, in hard work, and they are more creative, and we need an exchange every now and then of people. So we need a fast and huge throughput of people, which is has been quite devastating, you know, for the young people and for a whole generation. So that has happened, and there has been this campaign here in Germany, I Am Hannah, that referred to this whole life existing on internships and temporary contracts until when you're 40 or 45, you're thrown out completely. So and a lot of people had to live these lives. But that wasn't due to anti-science. In a sense, on the contrary. It was due to a certain understanding of science as a motor of competitiveness and a certain understanding of competitiveness.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I hadn't thought of it in that way, but it really makes sense that in some ways part of this crisis, and I think we have it in Sweden too, there was sort of strong neoliberalization here in the mid-90s onwards, and you see this precariousness in academia quite clearly. Then I can ask you maybe about your earlier editorials, where you had asked quite a few questions. I think that all of those questions are really critical and important to take up. But one of those questions was, and it remains quite relevant today, I think, is what exactly is the difference between democratizing expertise and promoting right-wing populism? And so even after Trump's loss, you know, some of those dynamics remain. And a colleague has pointed out that, you know, for example, when it comes to media, that in a neoliberal sort of setting, individuals have this illusory freedom of choice, but practically it just doesn't exist. And they know that, they recognize it. And the contract between journalists and audiences has been sort of hollowed out because of that. And I thought there's also a contract between expertise or, you know, maybe the scientific community, but also experts that advise government and the public, and that relies on trust, and maybe, you know, that's been hollowed also in some ways.
Yeah, that's true. Well, one thing to remark on that point is that, at least here, of course, these people who deny, for instance, climate change or who don't believe in the official assessment of the pandemic, and they also refer to to experts and expertise very right. strongly. Yeah. It's just they have their own or alternative experts, if you want, and they come up with figures and with numbers and with studies and all of that. So it's not that expertise as such is refuted in wholesale in toto. I wouldn't say that. It's more that there is this mistrust in those who are assumed to ally with the government or with maybe the industry in the case of the pandemic as well.
Also, you had asked, you know, where is the line between analysis and contribution? And I like that question also.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a lot of self-criticism in my community, in this critical policy community, and also in science and technology studies, where I come from. You know, I mean, Bruno Latour has been one of them who started this discourse, saying, well, we always said science is a construction, there is no yeah. facts and values dichotomy, and it always depends on what you want to see and what you highlight and so on and so forth. And now there's climate change denial, and we are part of the problem. We aren't we culpable, or aren't we to blame as well for the effect? But I think that is actually, in the case of the piece of Latour, I thought he was overestimating himself, maybe. I think he put too much importance on the effects he had with his writing. I think that didn't cause climate change denial. It wasn't that. Yeah, but the difference is really, we have to see that there are different approaches in science, that there's different expertise, and there are different results, and that is an ongoing contestation and conversation, if it's good, or contestation. Mm-hmm. That's all true, but that's not the same as saying, well, there are just facts and alternative facts. That's not the same, because you have to give reasons for what you're doing. You have to account for it, and you have to show what you have done, and yeah. you have to make arguments and be, as I said, self-critical and self-reflexive. And that, I would say, is the difference. It isn't easy and doesn't always work, but that's the important thing about it.
No, I agree entirely. And you had also talked about a context-sensitive analysis. And I think that really is the key to it. And that's sort of what I had also mentioned in my own article, that you know, simplicity is quite easy and tempting, but yeah, we need sometimes to get into the complexities. You mentioned about Latour and science and technology studies. And I've, you know, one big strand of the sort of the origin story of post-truth was postmodernism, and people trace it back, you know, almost even like to the 1930s and so on. So, you know, when these first articles started coming out, there was a set of those that sort of, you know, proposed post-truth and then tried to analyze its origin. There was a set of articles that blamed the rise of postmodernism for bringing us into this post-truth world. They said that, you know, you started eroding our trust in facts and truth and so on by relativizing everything.
Yes, that's another part of the story that's Mark Lilla, amongst others, right? He's complaining that an allegedly existing feeling of unity and community and a universal community in the United States right. has been destructed or lost by these postmodernists. And right. I don't know what unity and what community he has been talking about. I mean, you have lived in the States. I lived there only for 2 years, but I think African-American people would really ask you some questions about that. Where has that been in the past?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say that that idyllic past is, you know, is always invoked in this sense with the community, but with post-truth also, you know, that there was an idyllic truth world and it's sort of then been destroyed. Well, I guess I have sort of asked you what I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, tough questions, I must say. No, these are really very valid questions to be discussed further, I would say. And I would love to, if you have more discussions, more podcasts and interesting conversations, I would really love to follow those. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. Many thanks to all of you for listening to this episode. I hope you found the discussion of post-truth from a critical policy studies framework useful. I hope also that you will join me for the next episode in which I speak with Catherine Happer about post-truth in the context of media and related issues. If you liked what you heard, do alert your friends and colleagues and share the podcast. As always, please visit the website for links to additional information related to the episode. Thanks and bye for now.